Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, Azerbaijan, Russia and Turkey. Who's allied with whom? It's all rather more complicated than you might think. Also, radical countryside. Are innocuous-sounding rural meetings hiding a darker agenda?
What emerges at these meetings is something very different to on the leaflet. There's talk of the amount of machinery farmers have, that being needed because farmers will be up against the army.
And a bridge too far. All the latest on Czechia's hottest infrastructure debate. That's all here on Inside Europe. We begin the programme in the far eastern reaches of Europe, the Caucasus, a region that Moscow's rulers, all the way back to the Tsars, have traditionally seen as their backyard. However, Russia's grip on the region appears to be rapidly loosening, just one of the unforeseen repercussions of its ongoing war of aggression in Ukraine. Azerbaijan, itself a petrostate, albeit on a smaller scale, is flexing its muscles and is engaged in a rapidly escalating exchange of tit-for-tat actions with its powerful Russian neighbour. Now, in the past, Baku could have been expected to rapidly back down, but those days are gone. And as our Istanbul-based reporter Dorian Jones reports, Azerbaijan's newfound confidence has a lot to do with its deepening military alliance with Turkey.
Azerbaijani social media is flooded with state-released videos of Russian journalists working for the Moscow-backed Sputnik broadcaster being arrested by masked police. Baku claims the arrests were in response to Sputnik continuing to broadcast after its license was revoked. Moscow slammed the detentions as political. The arrests follow outrage in Baku over the recent deaths of two Azerbaijanis in Russian custody and the detention of leading members of Azerbaijan's diaspora in Russia. Tensions between the neighbours have been escalating since December's accidental downing of an Azerbaijani Airlines jet by Russian missiles, and Baku's demands for a full apology and compensation all rejected by Moscow. Zal Gazimov of the German Academic Exchange Service is an expert on Azerbaijani-Russian relations. Gazimov says the arrest of the Russian journalists is a sign that Baku is ready to stand up to its powerful neighbour over the deaths of its citizens and wider Russian pressure.
That was quite shocking for Baku, for Azerbaijani society, the cruelty of the behaviour and the large scale of the violence, actually. And the Russia-wide persecution of the leaders of Azerbaijani diasporic organisations took place. This kind of news had to frighten the Azerbaijani society that is aware of the fact that around 2 million of ethnic Azeris with Azerbaijani passports and with Russian passports have been living in the Russian Federation. So the signal is we can oust them. They would come to Azerbaijan. That should be an economic threat. But the reaction of Azerbaijan was just to react with tit-for-tat tactics.
In a calculated move to further anger Moscow, Baku is also stepping up its non-military support to Ukraine. Earlier this year, Baku accused Moscow of being behind a nationwide cyber attack. Farid Shafiev, chairman of the Baku-based Center for Analysis of International Relations, says that with Russia weakened by a costly war with Ukraine, Moscow must understand that the South Caucasus can no longer be viewed as its backyard.
You know, we, Azerbaijan, always tried to accommodate Russian geopolitical interests in the South Caucasus with two red lines: territorial integrity of Azerbaijan and sovereignty, independence. And looks like the Russians, they cannot get accustomed to that situation. But overall, the South Caucasus is changing, first of all, because of Russian-Ukrainian war. Second, because of just trajectory from the collapse of the Soviet Union. The third very important factor is the Turkish factor.
Turkey, a long-time ally of Azerbaijan, in recent years has stepped up its military cooperation and the sale of arms. Turkish-made drones were key to defeating Armenian-backed forces in 2020 and recapturing the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. In 2021, the Shusha Convention was signed, in which Baku and Ankara militarily guarantee their security in the event of war. Turkey is also planning to build one of its largest military bases in Azerbaijan. Analyst Gazimov says deepening cooperation with Ankara is a key factor in Baku's newfound assertiveness.
A very strong relationship with Ankara, a very strong cooperation in the economic field, in the military field for decades, coined also by Shusha Declaration several years ago. That is an asset, and that is one of the elements of Azerbaijan's growing self-conscience. But the same goes also to a quite sophisticated diplomacy Baku launched, forging strong relationship in economic terms with the West, with the European Union.
The EU in 2022 committed itself to a major expansion in purchases of Azeri gas as part of efforts to diversify away from Russian energy. The Azeri gas is piped through Turkey to Europe. Turkish forces thwarted a Russian-backed warlord in Libya, while Ankara-backed rebels ousted Moscow's ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Turkish and Russian presidents once boasted of a close relationship. Still, analyst Atilla Yeşilada of Global Source Partners claims Ankara's triumphs at Moscow's expense are starting to take a toll on their relationship.
No doubt that the Putin-Erdogan relationship is not as good as it used to be because of what we have either instigated or became participants of events in South Caucasus and Syria. But the economic interests are so huge that there is a huge chasm between not being too friendly and being antagonistic. I don't think we got to that point. If we did, we would see serious provocations in Turkey.
Until now, Turkish and Russian leaders have successfully compartmentalized their differences. But Azerbaijani analyst Shafiev questions whether Moscow will be prepared to peacefully relinquish a region it has historically considered to be firmly within its sphere of influence.
We don't know what will be Russia's next target. We cannot exclude that Russia might be quite assertive in the South Caucasus in the future. But again, we should think about cost. Because I think the easiest way to build friendly relationship, economic partnership with the countries of the South Caucasus. But unfortunately, Moscow looks like it's not ready for equal partnership. But if it's ready, we would welcome.
Erdogan routinely describes Azerbaijan and Turkey as one people, two states. A commitment that could well be put to the test if Moscow refuses to give up its centuries of control of the Caucasus. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Geopolitical ripples at the eastern edges of the European pond, an area to watch going forwards. Right now, though, our focus is about to shift to somewhere, for me at least, much closer to home, the English countryside. And for this trip, I've booked us a guide.
I'm Tom Wakeford. I am one of a group called Seeding Reparations, and I've been researching and being actively involved in anti-racist initiatives for about 20 years.
In order to bring Seeding Reparations' most recent research to life, I have invited Tom Wakeford to take us on an imaginary journey into the heart of rural England. Where are we, Tom?
We are in a market town in the county, the English county of Gloucestershire. Stroud has a small branch of a railway line. It is in lovely rolling hills. It has beautiful buildings from the 19th century, and it's a lovely place to visit. Many people moved there during the pandemic to be among other like-minded people. Many environmentalists live there, and it also has organic and other alternative farming approaches adopted in the villages and towns around it.
It sounds idyllic. Why are we here, Tom?
We're here because it is one of many places where there have been meetings held and there are future meetings planned with food security on the agenda, but actually things like dabbling with what I would call far-right and conspiracy theory discussions alongside food security.
You've sent me actually a flyer. I'm going to read a bit. Supporting Farmers for Food Security Symposium 2025. Let's work together for food security now and for future generations. We will learn about some of the great schemes that enable the public to buy top quality food direct from farmers and discover how we can help to set these up ourselves, learning from those already making it work for their communities. I mean, what's not to like?
Well, yeah, that does sound lovely. And I think what we at Seeding Reparations have been doing over the last couple of years is looking at where these sorts of phrases come from, where the resonance comes from in the British countryside. And the truth, as with other European countries and North America, is that lots of these ideas about being sovereign over the land, doing things environmentally, have a rather dark history. The phrase blood and soil is often used, the idea of tying native people, their ties to their indigenous lands. And of course, in a world where lots of people are on the move and lots of people go and live in other places, I think it's quite a worrying framing of these issues, and one that has been taken up by an international TV personality, Jeremy Clarkson, who during the farmers' campaign against a tax increase started talking about the ethnic cleansing of farming to allow housing for migrants. So this is the context, and that was also taken up by a far-right political party. So it's there's more going on than just wanting to eat a nice local apple from a local tree.
So much to unpick there, and I want to sort of delve into these ideas and their origins with you a little bit later, but just sort of staying in Stroud for the minute, I'm just sort of imagining that I am picking up this leaflet and it sounds interesting. You know, I've got a countryside background myself. I'd be really up for meeting people who are into organic farming and have ideas about how we might approach food security going forwards. I go along. What am I likely to find at this meeting? Who will be there and what kind of ideas will I be hearing?
What emerges at these meetings is something very different to on the leaflet. There's talk of the amount of machinery farmers have, that being needed because farmers will be up against the army. There's a real classic sort of rhetoric around us against this other, language that's remnant of some of the US talk show hosts that talk about it being a war and people needing to take sides. So either on the side of localness and ecology and supporting local people and local farmers, or we're with this unknown other. And I think the worry is what's sometimes put in that box of others is, as TV personalities like Jeremy Clarkson and even politicians have said, is that these are migrants. And so this is the sort of the undertone. And there's even talk at one of the meetings of Greta Thunberg, the environmental activist, being funded by Jewish financiers. So it's that kind of conspiracy land.
So the enemy isn't climate change then?
No, apparently climate change is itself a conspiracy. These sorts of groups often have links to people that were exchanging messages during the pandemic that COVID was a conspiracy, climate change was a conspiracy, and what's needed is to just reject all that and just focus on growing food for local people. So very much a sort of shut out the world and let's just be together in this local area feeding each other.
So many of the concerns, you know, that there is indeed a massive sort of shift happening in the countryside, a move away from the heavy pesticide use and monoculture. That forms a core part of very legitimate thinking in terms of the way in which we might reimagine the future of our countryside and our relationship to it. So how am I to know what is a dangerous sort of gateway to more pernicious thinking? And what is a genuine and well-intentioned attempt to think through real problems?
Yeah, it's a real dilemma because rural areas, and I grew up in one as well, they don't really have an infrastructure for people to learn about what's happening, what forces are controlling the rural areas and decisions that are made about rural areas. And what they're getting instead is a sort of meetings where you get some simple slogans and very simplistic analysis. And people are then asked to join mailing lists and maybe asked to turn up to express their views along with others on something they haven't really understood. They feel they've understood it, but it is often taking it in directions that are dangerous for minorities in the community, whether they be racial minorities, migrant workers, and the WhatsApp groups that became particularly widely used during the pandemic, I think are being used to sort of like bring people into events like this and potentially making them foot soldiers for something that could be much darker.
And the idea that there might be something coordinated, something darker behind that, what kind of signs would I have to be alive to if I were there and I were sort of, you know, trying to make sure that I wasn't being manipulated?
There are all sorts of leaflets passed out at these events. One that has been studied in quite some depth by journalists and anti-racist researchers is a magazine that again dates to or became prominent during the pandemic called The Light. And that contains very clearly rhetoric of the Great Replacement Theory. So the idea that people are coming over to the land of the indigenous white people to replace them.
And the organisers of events like these, do we have any evidence that they're connected? Is there a common funding stream? Or is it just that they're putting out uncannily similar content and this is an area that needs further investigation?
It definitely needs further investigation. We don't necessarily have evidence of money passing through bank accounts, but the stories that are being told, the narratives that are coming out of far-right politicians' mouths, gives us all the evidence we need that these are something we really need to pay attention to, in that rural areas, people of colour experience them as hostile spaces, and they could become much worse.
Tom Wakeford is co-author of Organicism and Fascism in the UK, A Little Book of Legacies. We'll be linking to that Seeding Reparations publication in the show notes. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. About a bit of bridge building to round us off. No, not metaphorical. I'm talking about the real thing. Our story comes to us from Prague, often hailed as Europe's best preserved capital, with over 1,000 years of architecture, all contained within one walkable city. Most visitors make a beeline for the 14th century Charles Bridge, but there is another bridge making headlines at the moment, an arched steel structure that has been part of the city's southern skyline for over 100 years, but is now under threat. Here is Rob Cameron's report from the Czech capital.
Take a train from Prague's main station to the spa town of Karlovy Vary, the birthplace of modern brewing at Pilsen, or even distant Bavaria, and you'll cross this, the rickety, rusty Vyšehrad railway bridge across the River Vltava. For the past 123 years, it served as a vital rail link between Prague and points westwards, and despite its age, the bridge still handles a large proportion of the capital's rail traffic. But years of wear and tear and not much maintenance has left it in a parlous state. And now the railway authority wants to tear it down and build a new one. Pavel Paidar, head of construction planning, insists the bridge is no longer in a state to meet the railway's requirements.
Ten stav z našeho pohledu je nelichotivý.
From our perspective, it's not in a very good condition. It has to be monitored constantly. Extensive surveys have been carried out which revealed that fatigue cracks are now forming. It's a steel bridge and it's an old one, and that's showing in terms of wear. Even now, it has to withstand a significantly higher load capacity than it was originally designed for. What's crucial is that this is one of the most heavily used railway bridges in Prague. It carries 3/4 of the total rail traffic that passes over all railway bridges in the city.
The railway authority says around 70% of the steel is so rusty it needs to be replaced. They plan to dismantle the bridge altogether and replace it with a new steel structure mounted on the current stone foundations. But that's angered those who want the old bridge to stay. They say only around 15% of the steel is unsalvageable. The Vyšehrad Bridge, they say, forms such an important part of Prague's industrial heritage, it should be repaired, not replaced. Petr Tej is an architect and bridge specialist.
The bridge was built in 1902 by the Czech engineer and architect František Prošvíl. By the way, he was the guy who built the Petrin Lookout Tower, which was inspired by the Eiffel Tower. And in a way, Prošvíl is our Eiffel, or yes, maybe our Brunel. That's the way we think of him. So this bridge is a really important layer of Prague's architectural history, and it should stay where it is.
Petr is part of a collective called the Vyšehrad Bridge Foundation, which has brought together architects, engineers, heritage campaigners, local politicians, 25,000 residents who've signed a petition, and also UNESCO. The foundation insists the bridge can be repaired in situ at a fraction of the cost and without completely disrupting railway traffic. They also scoff at the railway authority's plan to move the original bridge upstream to a far narrower stretch of the river in the south of Prague to serve as a new footbridge. Plonking down an industrial urban railway bridge in the middle of a meadow will be ridiculous, they say. Tomáš Bystrický is the organization's co-founder.
What's really interesting is that the bridge has been serving the city for more than 120 years. And the study that we commissioned with the help of Swiss and British bridge engineers has shown us that it will serve another 100 years, which I think is a fantastic example of the advanced level of bridge building in the Czech lands at the time.
In a city where architecture is cherished as a national treasure, the debate over the Vyšehrad Bridge strikes a deep chord. But ultimately, the final decision may rest not with engineers or with conservationists, but with the Czech cabinet. With elections due in the autumn and a change of government likely, the only question now is which government that will be. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
This is Inside Europe. Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn, welcoming you to a glorious European summer, complete with river diving, bears, campervans, and traditional alcoholic beverages. That's right, the summer season is upon us and our correspondents are in holiday mood. At least one of them so much so that they were even prepared to strip down to their Speedos in the name of European journalistic best practice. Our Paris correspondent, John Laurenson, has been testing out one of three new bathing sites which have opened up in the French capital, a key part of the city's Olympic legacy and a major milestone for the Seine, which has been closed to swimmers for over 100 years due to pollution. Vas-y alors, John.
I was more than sceptical when I got out of the metro and walked the short distance to the river. Think of the rats swimming in it, the people peeing into it, the numbers of houses upstream that still haven't been hooked up to the sewage system, the industrial waste, quite possibly, although given the state of French industry, it would be almost good news to have this sign of life. Even the swallows seem to scream, "Don't do it." But when the swimming station, as Paris Town Hall calls it, comes into view, I'm kind of starting to get into it already. Paris has opened three swimming spots, one near the Ministry of Finance, one near the Eiffel Tower, and this one near Notre Dame in the oldest part of Paris, in front of the island in the river that is the Île Saint-Louis. We're like 10 in the morning, it's a beautiful day, there's some quite classy wooden decking and the whole swimming area is shaded by some tall plane trees. The queue, like the Seine, moves swiftly. But I have time to ask one of the staff about the incredibly short opening hours here and the fact that you're only allowed into the water if you strap on an inflatable yellow floaty thing.
Ah, d'accord.
Okay,
d'accord.
We close here at 11:30 a.m., she explains, because that's when navigation starts on the river. The bateaux mouches, sightseeing boats, barges and so on. You wouldn't think it'd be dangerous, I suggest, because the swimming area is delimited. We want zero risk, she replies. We don't want a swimmer getting caught in a propeller. Same logic for the rather infantilising floaty things. They don't want anyone staying under the water. Making the Seine clean enough to swim in has cost about 1.4 billion euros. It's a project very much associated with Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo. She doesn't want a nasty accident making it look bad. In any case, I am now down to my trunks and with required yellow floater dangling, doing something, to be quite honest, I never thought I would do. Going into the River Seine of my own free will.
It's actually quite nice. I can feel the current. And it is beautiful, I must say. The bridges, the lovely buildings of the Île Saint-Louis, the poplar trees down on the quay. It's really lovely.
So I love it, basically. And so does everybody else.
So what did you think?
I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. It's a lot. It sort of feels cleaner than you would expect. It's certainly cleaner than filthy beaches around the Laguna of Venice or something. It's feels like a lake. It's lovely.
And what about the floaty thing that you have to attach yourself to?
Not a problem, really.
I love it.
Yeah, can I ask you what you thought of this?
This was wonderful. This is a wonderful experience that we haven't got to do in a really long time. A different experience of Paris that all of the people that I've talked to that wanted to do this have never got to do, right?
And how about the cleanliness of the water?
We compared it to a river, but not as fishy as the rivers that we're around. So we'll take it.
The temperature was really, really nice. The current, I mean, it was very calm. In terms of cleanliness, I don't know. It didn't seem that dirty. I didn't see that much like plastic or waste. Algae, obviously, but it is a body of water, so normal.
It was nice. Cold, but not so cold. And the weather was nice. And just swimming next to my house is nice.
Wow, okay, you live right here?
Yeah, 5 minutes away, so it's cool. Every day I come.
It's going to completely change your summer in Paris.
Yeah, it's like we're in Marseille now. Almost.
Though afterwards, I venture to the deck chairs not far from the swimming zone, where some swimmers are now chilling, but where some others are holding out against the whole swimming in the Seine thing.
Would you be tempted by a little swim in the Seine?
I mean, I would be tempted for a swim. It's very hot, but not in Seine.
No?
At least not in this area. Maybe, what? Like, further away?
Why not? It kind of looks...
No, but it was, like, full of, like, trash, just, like, 100 really? Meters that way. Yeah, oh, okay. like bottles and everything, so...
Oh, okay.
No,
but... Here it looks kind of clean, though. You must admit.
Yeah, it is.
It looks clean.
It looks clean, but I feel like it can't be clean.
So, any unwanted effects after my swim? Well, funny you should ask, because even though I felt great, I did notice a slight burning sensation in my chest, which lasted a couple of hours. So here's my advice. Smoke, don't inhale. Drink, 3 glasses max. Swim in the Seine, yes, but with your head out of the water.
John Laurenson making a literal splash there. Paris is, of course, one of the most established and iconic of European tourist destinations. But if you're looking for something a little more off the beaten track this summer, then may I suggest that you try out the village billing itself as Europe's first ever Bear Smart community. And no, we're not taking you to the forests of Finland or the mountains of Romania, but to the central Italian village of Pettorano sul Gisio, where brown bears really do regularly wander into gardens. So, how is the community dealing with these overly curious ursine visitors? Angela van Schaik has been finding out.
Domenico Bontatibus has a beautiful garden with a view of the Apennine Mountains.
Dunque, è successo nel 2023.
As we stand in his garden, he's telling me about a furry visitor he had a couple of summers ago, when a bear wandered into his garden in search of figs. Bears have a real sweet tooth, he says.
Quando abbiamo fatto il filmato era la sera.
Domenico installed a motion detecting camera to capture the bear's visits, enabling him to watch the bear running around in his garden in the evenings. On one particular evening, a neighbor warned Domenico about a bear in the vicinity. It turned out to be his frequent guest, this time having devoured all the remaining figs in his yard. Domenico and a neighborhood bear live in Pettorano sul Gisio, a village of about 400 inhabitants in the central Italian region of Abruzzo. In the mountains surrounding the village live around 100 Marsican brown bears, a subspecies of the brown bear found only in this area. They regularly visit the village in search of food. A decade ago, a serious incident involving one of them occurred here.
Nasce in seguito un episodio molto grave che è avvenuto qui a Pettorano.
A bear was shot dead by a resident after reportedly breaking into his chicken coop and eating his chickens, says Angela Tavone, a volunteer with Rewilding Apennines.
Una volontaria da proprio dal 2015 ha deciso di cambiare prospettiva.
Angela tells me the uproar surrounding the bear's death led to the founding of a project to reduce human-bear conflicts, helping people be more comfortable with these massive animals. One of the ways to help people get to know the Marsican bear better is through a permanent exhibition in the castle of Pettorano sul Gisio. In a former shepherd's hut attached to the castle, a bear den has been set up to simulate hibernation.
Il respiro degli orsi in ibernazione, quello più forte è quello della mamma, quello più debole è quello dei cuccioli.
Angela explains that visitors hear what a bear sounds like during hibernation. The mother bear breathes loudly, while you can also hear respiration from 2 quieter baby cubs. During hibernation, a bear breathes about 2 times per minute, Angela explains. Their heart rate slows down to 10 beats per minute, basically shutting their bodies down. The cubs are born during hibernation in January and stay in the cave with mum until spring arrives. Besides helping people understand bears better, the project to create a bear smart community also finds ways to keep bears away from where humans don't want them.
Quindi dal 2015 abbiamo iniziato a costruire recinti elettrificati per tutte le proprietà che avessero animali da
cortile. We've installed electric fencing in gardens with fruit trees, beehives, or where people keep small animals like chickens or rabbits, Angela tells me. Her organization also advises residents to install special bear-resistant doors on their chicken coops and bear-proof bins. These measures make it less appealing for hungry bears to wander into town. Just outside Petrano sul Gizio flows the small river Gizio, from which the village gets its name. This area is frequently visited by bears, and Mario Cipollone from Rewilding Apennines regularly finds traces here.
Siamo in questa zona di Pettorano che spesso è frequentata dagli orsi.
He found a bear footprint here in September, which he measured and photographed. He tells me of other traces of bears in the area, like bear scat, fur on trees where they scratch themselves, or overturned rocks where bears search for insects to eat.
Noi conduciamo questo monitoraggio d'accordo con gli enti.
He uses all of these signs to determine what the bear's range is in the area. Since Pettorano sul Gizio became the first bear smart community in Europe, the number of tourists has been increasing. More than tenfold in 5 years. And recently, the local population has also started to grow again. Local resident Bruno saw an opportunity to breathe new life into the local bar he owns, but that had been closed for years.
Noi l'abbiamo fatto maggiormente per far riprendere sto borgo.
He says he reopened his bar to bring a bit of life back to the village, comparing the square it sits on to that of Capri, with its beautiful view. Though Bruno's nearing retirement, he tells me he decided to give his business one more go, thanks to the bear curious tourists flooding in. Tourism has grown a lot, confirms Marco Finocchi from tourist organization Valle Luna.
È aumentata la quantità di turisti in maniera esponenziale. Questo è dovuto.
Until a few years ago, he says, you could count the number of bed and breakfasts on one hand. Now there are 27. And Marco feels that this new surge of tourism is more friendly to nature.
Lei ha fatto dei recinti per
ecco qua,
me la far vedere.
Back in Domenico Bontatibus' garden. He tells me that he's found a way to keep the bear out of his yard, thanks to help from Rewilding Apennines.
L'anno scorso, nel 2024, abbiamo fatto un recinto, una elettrificazione.
He shows me the electric fence they installed, from the wall on one side of the garden all the way across to the other. Bears learn, he tells me. When they feel that electric shock, they don't come back. Since installing the fence, he and his camera haven't seen the bear again. The death of local resident Andrea Papi stirred up the debate about the bear population in the north of Italy. He was killed by a brown bear while jogging in the mountains of Trentino. Many people in that area think bears should not live in such a densely populated area and believe that removing or even killing them would be the best option. In the center of the country, people think there should be another way to deal with a nosy animal. Being bear smart is their solution. The Marsican bears have been living in Abruzzo for centuries, so it's best to try and live together with them. And it seems to work, as many villages in other European countries have been following Pettorano's example. Angelo von Schaik, DW, Pettorano sul Gizio, Italy.
Do visit Europe's first ever Bear Smart community this summer. Don't take your camper van to Greece, or at least not if you're expecting to be able to park anywhere for free. Greece has introduced tough new laws prohibiting camping outside of official sites. For reporter Heidi Fuller Love, the sense of loss is palpable, as she explained in this very personal account recorded on location in her trusty camper.
freedom. It's something that seems increasingly rare these days. As a motor caravan owner for more than 30 years, it's that heady sense of freedom that I'm seeking when I park my van by a remote beach, make a meal from items bought in the local market, pour myself a glass of wine, and watch the sun sink behind a horizon that I've only just discovered. Like me, Nima from Bergen has spent many years travelling in Greece.
I've been living full-time in a camper van with my boyfriend for the last 9 years, and we have travelled Greece frequently. We always felt welcomed by the locals. One of the highlights for me is a mountain village in the Epirus where we went climbing for the first time. We liked the village so much that we traveled there again and again and were warmly welcomed by the locals.
The word philoxenia is Greek for love of the stranger, and it's definitely something I've experienced again and again in my campervan travels around Greece. All that, however, is about to change.
There's been a massive change in the laws regarding campervans and motorhomes nationwide, and it's a big one, unfortunately.
Sad news, guys. Greek government just banned all motorhomes from Greece.
If you were thinking of going to Greece in your campervan, now there is no point. Greece has basically banned campervans across the whole of the country.
Sweeping new laws introduced in January of this year forbid campervans and caravans from parking just about everywhere. Demosthenis Savrampis owns motor caravan hire company Lazy Snail Campers in Crete.
So if you want to drive from one town to another and you want to stop to go to the beach or visit an archaeological site, it's not allowed. And where it gets even more interested is like if you want to stop in a restaurant and there is another camper van stopped, you're not allowed to stop. Because we're in Greece, they just banned everything. It was just easier for them.
Since the laws were introduced, motorhome owners have faced fines of up to €300, or in some cases have even been arrested just for parking in a public spot.
For me, the government is overshooting the mark with the new law, as it basically makes it impossible to travel the country with a camper van. Greece is extremely damaging itself with this law, especially that there is no infrastructure for campers. At the moment, campers constantly have the feeling that they are criminals.
Sophia Wexler, who has travelled in Greece with her van for the past 16 years, believes that motor caravan owners should have seen it coming.
Before 2020, we were very few. We didn't have apps like Park for Night that, for example, this app and influencers making content about spots and places, these things drove to the situation happening now.
Demosthenis agrees that the situation did need regulating.
Because we're in Greece, they didn't take the time to have a proper scenario over all these things and find out how they can solve the problem. So instead of looking for results for this problem, they just banned everything. It was just easier for them.
The official explanation for cracking down on campervans is due to environmental damage. But according to Demosthenis and other professionals in the sector, the authorities have provided very little evidence to support the claim. At a time when Greece is fast-tracking sprawling resorts that are taking up large tracts of land and beach areas and causing endless environmental concerns, the government is facing accusations of hypocrisy, as Sophie Wexler comments.
But this new law is also a pretext to build more and more hotels. And it is not a hidden purpose of the government. It has been said, and it is said for many years.
Opposition party PASOK, who raised the question of the legality of the new laws in Parliament, say that the growing momentum of caravan and camping tourism in Europe is essentially untapped in Greece. They also point out that the new laws risk damaging the image of Greece as a country friendly to what they describe as the modern alternative traveller. In other words, people like me and my camper. Heidi Fuller-Love reporting from Crete.
DW did reach out to the Greek Tourism Ministry on multiple occasions with an invitation to participate in that report, but received no response. However, as a pole and canvas camper myself, I can perhaps offer up two little observations from my own recent holiday in the way of balance. Number one, camper vans are not what they used to be. Some of them are absolutely massive these days. And number two, there are many more of them on the roads, no doubt due to a COVID-era uptick in sales. Hopefully, Heidi Full of Love will not run me over when she hears this. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Now, if you are one of those super organised people who plans their holidays well in advance, then you may already be looking for travel tips for next year or even the year after. If that's you, then listen up. We have a tip for 2027 for you. That is when the Spanish town of Jerez de la Frontera is due to hold the next edition of its Copa de Jerez competition. No, it is not a flamenco contest, although congratulations to anyone who knew that this is indeed the same Jerez de la Frontera responsible for producing such flamenco legends as Lola Flores. It is, in fact, a sherry competition, the fortified wine being the other thing that the town is famous for producing. Our reporter Ashish Sharma was at this year's event, and if I tell you that it involved eight international tasting teams pairing a three-course meal with the best of Jerez sherries, then you will probably see why.
Against the backdrop of flamenco drifting out of bars and restaurants, the Copa de Jerez has been described as the culinary Olympic Games, as teams of chefs and wine experts, called sommeliers, gathered in the city to reveal their three-course meals, pairing wines for each dish to a panel of distinguished chefs. The event is organized by the Sherry Regulatory Council of Jerez.
Carmen Aumesquet, and I am the promotion director of the Consejo Regulador of Sherry Wines. Well, we really believe sherry is a very versatile and very gastronomic wine. It's a very complex wine in terms of aromas and flavors. Recently, it was seen as an aperitif wine, which was quite unfair. So 22 years ago, we decided to begin this international competition pairing sherry with different countries participating. The best way to enjoy sherry is with food, with different dishes.
Okay, well, I've managed to get onto the stage behind the scenes, so to speak. There's a bit of a break going on in the competition, so I'm going to have a chat with... Hello, Germany.
Hello.
How are you?
Jan Nachtigall, Restaurant Novanta. Germany has not a big sherry community, but it's always growing.
How long does it take to prepare a meal for this competition?
Ooh, it takes quite a while because you have to pair the different flavors of the sherry with your dish, and you have to keep trying. Maybe you think something is great, and then you try it the next time, and you think, oh, maybe I can change this, I can change this. So it can happen in one day, or a dish can evolve in a year.
So I'm Zoe Donadio, I work at a Prestige Green Michelin restaurant.
Zoe, when you guys made your presentation, it really struck me because you made a really big point about sustainability. How important is that in terms of elite cuisine that we see these days?
I think it's more and more relevant, and I think everyone trying to have a better impact, and it's just figuring out how we go about having like high-level gastronomy, which can be done in a circular way, even just from where you store things, where you package things, Tupperware is reusable things, and cutting down on single-use, but also kind of moderating our wastage in terms of the food side of things, but also in the wine side of things, you know, supporting people who work in a responsible manner, with no additives, no chemicals, and usually those tend to be the highest quality wines anyway, so...
Germany, UK, Mexico were joined in the competition by teams from Spain, the USA, Netherlands, Belgium and Denmark. The event brings in everyone from connoisseurs of fine Jerez wines to tourists who want to learn more about the historical link that Sherry has with this region.
Well, I've just walked through the showroom where there is a wine festival taking place, and I've just stepped outside because I'm joined by Pablo Rincón, who is the quality control for wine for a company called
Archeo Gastronomía.
Thank you. I knew I'd get that bit wrong. How important is wine to the economy of this Jerez region?
It is one of the pillar stones of the economy in Jerez. The winemaking here is something so embedded in the culture that the architecture of the city is conditioned by this profession. Most of the old buildings are old cellars, actually. The whole city is around the wine.
The two-day event has become a showcase opportunity for local bodegas. One of the oldest bodegas, Sanchez Romate, had the youngest staff members. I spoke to Blanca and Lucia.
60 or 70% of our winery is exported. So I think it's very important to have chefs that are very well known internationally to come here and get to know better our brands.
Yeah, Lucia, you and Blanca both seem very young, but are you finding that a lot of young people are also interested in it?
It's well known that young people is drinking less, so we're trying to catch this kind of market. We're trying to approach young people like us, because Blanca and I, we love wines, and that's why our winery has people like us of our age in order to catch with other people like us.
The surprising winner of the Copa de Jerez was Denmark, which impressed the panel with an adventurous combination of food and wines. Their unexpected victory, coupled with teams entering from as far away as Mexico in the USA, shows that the market for sherry is becoming more diverse. This is good news for the local industry, which depends on the product, but also means that the message from the organisers that sherry is a versatile drink that matches most meals is also being heard. Ashish Sharma, DW, Jerez de la Frontera.
Nice try, Ashish, but I still think that I'm going to file sherry competitions away under perks of the job. If you head on over to Spotify, you will find that our poll of the week is all about favourite European holiday destinations. What's yours? Drop us a line at insideeurope.com or leave us a voice message at speakpipe.com/insideeurope. We would love to hear from you. Inside Europe is, of course, available on all the other usual platforms too, as is Living Planet, DW's environment programme. I wonder what they're up to this summer.
Summer is here and vacation is calling. So at the end of July, we're bringing you a special series with our favourite tips for living a greener life. From what to look out for in your sunscreen to how to reduce your dog's environmental paw print, we'll get insights and advice from the experts and have a look at our own habits. Find our Greener Living series from Living Planet wherever you get podcasts.
This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, and Laura Kabelka. Our sound engineer was Ziad Abu Sleiman. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.